Hello, this time around, Bowler's Desk Political Podcast with me, Matt Bowler, and Rick Epps, Dr. PhD, linebacker, comic book nerd, Rick Epps. This week, we met over off of 6th Avenue in Balboa Park in between the Bridge Club. I thought it was the Chess Club. Chess Club is a little bit further south down 6th Avenue, but this was the Bridge Club and the 6th Avenue Playground, which is incidentally a very cool looking playground. And if I was young, I'm young at heart, but I'm not young at back, and it looks like a lot of fun. 6th Avenue Playground, it was a great day. It was nice, shady. We had a nice shady spot on a picnic table, which was perfect because I really had sunburn last time, and I'm all about shade at the park. And we hung out there and talked about the stuff that Rick and I love to hang out and talk about, which was politics in the world. This time around, we also shot video of our chat, and they're going to be up on YouTube in segments. So if you want to check it out there, you can as well. But the whole podcast will be on iTunes like it normally is. So there you go. So you've got a bunch of different ways now. You can watch and listen on your phone, on your iTunes. You can watch on your computer or on your TV. If you've got Apple TV now, pick out the little segments. And this time around, we talked about Mayor Filner and the feds looking into him. Possible violation, possible quid pro quo kind of arrangement, maybe? I don't know. We'll see what comes of it. Prop 8's continuing saga, how that situation is going to evolve. Of course, Obama, Cairo, and Islam and democracy. Why can't Cairo just issue a vote of no confidence and elect a new prime minister? Why can't their democracy just work? Kind of a big question, a complicated question, and of course much, much more. If you've got any ideas, hop on the soapbox. Give us a call, 619-663-4531. 619-663-4531. Hop on the soapbox, tell us what you think. We might just put it in the podcast. And now you might end up on the YouTube channel. So listen, watch, share. Bowler's Desk, political podcast. So this week, in lovely Balboa Park again, over off of, near 3100 6th Avenue, right here in between the Children's Museum, and I think that's the Chess Club?
The Chess Club.
This is the San Diego Chess. I've never been in there. Have you been in there?
No, I play checkers, I'm a checkers man, sorry.
I didn't even know there was a San Diego Chess Club.
Yeah.
Until I drove by and saw.
Yeah, my grandfather taught us how to play when we were kids, and then somehow, life happened.
My father, when he was in the Air Force, that's how he earned money to buy my mother's engagement ring, was hustling chess and pool.
Really?
Against the officers, because, you know, my dad went to prep school.
Yeah. Okay?
He went to all-boys Catholic high school. He went to uni back in the 60s.
Oh, wow.
So
what did it prep him for?
Didn't prep him for much. And then, you know, joined the Air Force when he was, got married at 19 and joined the Air Force at 19.
Wow.
Joined the Air Force at 18.
Wow.
Anyhow, so he's off in the Air Force and they sent him to Colorado Springs for his training because he was doing some funky radar thing. But none of the officers, because the mentality, the officers always thought, oh, this enlisted guy, you know, these enlisted people don't.
Yeah.
Stupid or whatever.
He's way smarter than all of them.
And he played them big time, and he would play them up, and he was there, and these officers, and all of a sudden it's like he's up $500, which back then was apparently a ton of money, enough to buy a little engagement ring.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's great.
But unfortunately, all he knows how to do is hustle chess. So he didn't really teach me how to play. He just kept beating me over and over again.
The little guy goes this way.
He'd make me think I had some skills, and then he would destroy me. That's what you do.
Build you up, cut you down. See? Son, you have to learn how to deal with adversity.
This is life, right?
No. Hey, look, I used to hustle haircuts, man. I made money cutting.
Hustle haircuts?
Yeah, I used to cut because nobody wanted to go to the barber and pay money. So I would just charge them, I forgot what, maybe $5, and I would cut their hair on the weekend. So after we got off duty, I would spend it a couple hours, and I'd make extra money on the weekends. That's how I made my hustle going out chasing girl money. You know?
Yeah. Huh.
I didn't chase them very far. It wasn't that much money, but it was certainly, at least I had more money than most people in there, you know?
When was, that was the 80s?
I'm not even going to tell you that, man.
70s,
no, I'm
80s?
Not.
18?
Well, it depends on, you're talking about dog years or, yeah. or if you were in Jupiter, it was, let's see. No, it was a while back. It was 19 and
something in a cheap haircut now.
Yeah,
it's $20.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's do some just for inflation.
Exactly. Yeah. Even my son's haircuts. I'm thinking about starting to cut his hair myself. So
we just snuck up on my kid to cut his hair. I just put him in front. He stares at Mickey, and then I sneak up behind him with scissors.
I know. I was shocked when I saw him today in his hair. You know, usually he looks like
I did. Yeah, he had that shaggy mullet thing.
Yeah,
We couldn't deal with it.
Kind of like yours used to look like, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, until last week I got my hair cut. Yeah.
I'm not showing the picture I showed Matt earlier of me back in the day with my long hair, but may it stay where it came from, to say the least.
So anyhow, so we're here. This week was all, for me at least, locally, it was all about Filner. And the feds looking at him for that donation. And then he does a couple things. So first, let me explain how I understand this to be happening.
Okay.
So his wife runs a nonprofit, right? Mm-hmm. And Sun Road wants an easement on some construction because they're building another... because they're developers and they build large buildings.
Yeah.
Sun Road, they were the people that built that building that was two stories too high next to the airport in Kearney Mesa. So they had to, and Mike Aguirre spent like 3 years suing them back when he was city attorney.
Yeah.
And then they had to chop off two stories off
the
building.
Yeah, well, Sun Road said, go to hell.
Uh-huh.
And then he sued Mike Aguirre said, no, you
he
go to
sued
hell.
Him, and then they chopped off the two stories off the building because it was a danger because airplanes could
crash right into
the fucking building.
Yeah.
You know, and so they wanted an easement for some construction because they were going a little bit into the sidewalk because there's like a certain amount of setback or one of those kinds of rules.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they wanted to go, I think it was like 3 feet. I mean, it was pretty minuscule. So they needed an adjustment. But it appeared as though Sun Road made a donation to Filner's wife, girlfriend. I don't understand. Is he married? Is that technically his wife? Or is it just his long-term girlfriend? I think it's his long-term.
I don't know if they're married or not. It's a good question.
I don't know. And made a donation to her pet charity, her big charity, $100,000, $200,000. Huh. And then they get their easement. Huh. And it appeared as though, and the mayor and Filner even said, that this was essentially a quid pro quo kind of arrangement. You make this big donation to this pet project of mine, and then I'll help make sure that you get this easement
politics. It's politics.
Yeah, but the point was, is he was upfront about that at the press conference. There was this exchange.
Absolutely, yeah.
And normally they're just, you know, you just don't do those kinds of exchanges. Mm-hmm. Then he comes back later and says, I gave the money back. There was never that meant to be that arrangement. I gave all that money back. So nonetheless, it happened that it's just, you know, you would think as a mayor, right, it's that appearance of impropriety that you really have to watch out for,
absolutely,
not just the actual impropriety.
Absolutely.
And so the feds now are looking into it. And then this week, this issue's on the table. Instead of managing this, he goes off on Jack in a Box.
Yeah.
Just totally out of left field. The Jack in a Box wanted to remodel in Hillcrest or North Park, and they couldn't get permits to totally destroy the building, so they're boarding it up and they're kind of rebuilding it from the inside out, and I guess they consider a remodel. He's saying it's this. Who the fuck cares at this point? I don't understand.
Only Jack in a Box.
Yeah, but you know what I mean?
No, I know. I know.
Is he out of touch with what's going on? Does he think people aren't interested in these other issues?
Well, you know, it could be diversionary, you know, in some way, which would seem very minuscule and sort of simplistic. But on the other hand, you know, I mean, there's certainly, if you think about the community that he's talking about, it certainly might gain him some credibility, popularity within the Hillcrest community, which, you know, maybe he, you know, is trying to figure out who his constituents are, where he can find friends these days, because God knows he needs friends. And so because of that, that would be the only rationale that you could think of for wanting to take on this sort of minuscule, in some ways, and I don't want to minimize the issue, but minuscule sort of political issue, as opposed to the greater issue of his, you know, suspected impropriety.
Especially by comparison to, you know, what amounts to a buy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is what
they're saying is, well, that, is that Sun Road bought their building permits.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, I mean, and again, not for most people who understand even a little bit of politics, this is not a surprise. The question is, the feds are looking. It's going to be interesting to see what happens if they find anything. That's going to
Well, yeah, I mean, he's not stupid, but still.
Yeah. You don't have to be stupid to do dumb things.
Yeah. People do dumb things all the time.
Yeah, smart people do dumb things all the time.
Yeah. You know, but still, you know, and he gave, and he says, oh, well, I gave the money back. And I guess, suppose the question is, when did he give the money back?
Yeah. Oh,
right?
Yesterday.
And how are you gonna prove when he gave the money back?
Yeah, exactly. You know? Well, that's the other thing. I mean, and even during that questioning, he looked a little uncomfortable, you know, when I just kind of watched his body language, you know.
He doesn't seem to like to be questioned anything really. Yeah. I mean, none of them did. Let's say Sanders did not like to be questioned at all.
Yeah,
you
not
know?
At all.
And when people were holding him to task, and, you know, you got to give Carl DeMaio credit for a lot of things.
Yeah.
DeMaio held Sanders' feet to the fire in a lot of issues.
Yeah, he did.
They were both Republican, he represented his perspective and his constituents very well, and he fought for them, and he was a pain in the ass in the way that they elected him to be a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And they knew what they were getting when they voted, and that's why they put him in city council, because they knew exactly what kind of guy he was.
Exactly.
So he held, and Sanders, oh my God, this is the famous, you know, thing of Sanders saying, you know, calling DeMaio full of shit.
Yeah.
At one time. So it's not like Sanders could deal with being questioned the same way any better, than anybody else.
But yeah. He's human. He's human. I mean, that's the human response.
But
the
issues that he was dealing with were not anywhere nearly as serious as buying an easement or buying city council favor is what this accusation is.
I mean, and especially in light of the fact of the sort of the history of Sun Road and its sort of notion of sort of bullying its way to it to gain its own credibility and mm-hmm. to push its own policies, and so this, you know, this it's for people who remember what happened with Sun Road, you know, a few mm-hmm. years back, you know, that this you know, this does not speak well, because Sun Road is not the most popular company in San Diego for a lot of reasons. People who came through that period of time and watch them sort of snub their nose at, you know, what.
Well, they're major developers, and they just carry used to bullying their way through.
Exactly.
That's just the way it goes.
Exactly.
Times, you know?
And they're like, you're going to drink the Kool-Aid whether you like it or not. And so now, this potential of this for Filner is, I mean, it undermines its credibility. People are talking about, you know, wider ramifications. You know, is this mm-hmm. going to be something that's going to haunt him throughout his tenure as mayor? Will he survive this in his tenure as mayor? I think he probably will, but I don't. But I think it just adds more fuel to the anti.
This is the Jack in a Box in North Park, right on 30th and Upas.
Yeah,
you know which one I'm talking about.
I know exactly
about. It's right
you're
along
about.
That beer alley now.
Yeah.
That's that great like brew pub.
Yeah,
right there on 30th Street.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so they were talking about, yeah. So I'm looking at the Christy Wolski story that we ran on Fox 5. Here.
Yeah,
and you know, I mean, they boarded up the whole building. But
and then when they take the boards off, voila, you'll have a whole
new. Well, yeah, I mean, Jack in the Box.
It'll be called Jack. It'll be called Jack. It'll be called Jack in the Box.
Yeah, but they've been trying to reinvent their image for a long time too, because
Jack
in the Box has always been kind of the low rent.
Yeah.
I mean, at least when I was in college, it was the cheap food. It was the cheaper than cheap food. It was, you know, when your student loan money was down towards the end of the semester, you could go to Jack in a Box.
Yeah. Forget the gastro problems it caused, but
well,
at least
that's
you could,
all.
You know.
Yeah, well, when you're 19, I don't know if you worried too much about gastro.
Exactly.
Now it's a whole different story, right? Now I worry more about my tummy. But
exactly.
I could put anything on.
Yeah. Bread and water, that's all we get today, right?
Yeah. So his thing is like, you know, it just seems like such a distraction, and then he's got his monthly Filner meets the people kind of thing, where you can go and meet with Filner out at his office, right? People line up. I walked by one time and I was totally surprised to see all the line, but at the same time, the kind of person that's going to go down to meet with Filner on a Saturday morning is not necessarily your average voter. And that's kind of, I know he thinks this is his opportunity to be with the people, but this is more like an echo chamber for him.
Yeah.
This is him feeling good about himself.
Yeah, it's not him going into Southeast or somewhere and having a conversation with the people in the area and understanding their plights as much as it is about having an open door venue, you know, and saying you can come down and hang out if you want. And then the question is, you know, you see a long line, how many people really are going to hang out when you have a long line? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, most people.
And you should see some of the signs and some of the kind of people down there. It's a lot of fun.
I bet.
It's a little. They're a little goofy, man.
You know, we should go down there. We should
and
do.
Everybody's got their own proposal. Yeah.
We should do it from down there one day. But
yeah,
by
just
in front of,
show up.
Just show up. Be out in front of Filner's place get people to sort of respond with us on the air.
The Voice of San Diego did a good series where they went to each one of these over the period of 6 months and took pictures and talked about who these people were.
Uh-huh.
And they're all just kind of, I mean, some are have legitimate concerns, but they're all kind of wacky. You know, there's some really out there people that have all these, I'm going to solve the city's problem, stray dog problem, or some just weird ideas like this that don't seem to.
They're going to set up dog meat taco stands on each corner or something?
I don't know.
Just kidding. I like dogs, so don't take that the wrong way. But, you know, they're crazy. Believe me, there are people out there who, you know, there are people who are some different people out there. So you just never know where it's going to fall.
The Aztecs ate dog.
Yeah. Hey.
They did. I remember being they had all kinds of things.
Yeah, a little chimichurri sauce, you never know. You know,
Central Mexico, we'd go visit my wife's family, and they'd be selling. We'd look down, they had these big bags, and the bags were just like undulating. We picked them up, and they were like grubs and crickets and things
like
that.
Oh, yeah. Hey, look, that's on the Travel Channel where they have that guy who travels around the world eating.
I did not.
I'm sorry, you know what?
And we're like, oh, yeah, this is traditional. You should eat it.
Yeah, right. I know. Yeah, right. You know, I saw them eating baby pigs. I've seen them eating, you know, baby squids that were still alive. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm not feeling that at all.
You don't like squid? I love calamari.
Yeah, I like calamari when it's cooked, all right? You know, I'm not eating them when you give it to me live to chew on while its tentacles are going up my nose while I'm chewing it. No, I'm not feeling that so much now.
I don't know what that has to do with Filner.
Well, you know, if he gets up your nose, I don't know, man.
Okay, there you go.
Wow, get out of my nose.
I don't think there was much going on statewide this month, was there? I mean,
no,
there
just
was the normal stuff. I mean,
no, the problem. I mean, you know, I mean, it's interesting because what did happen is I said when I was on did my news segment last week, I said, you know, this issue's not over yet, and the Prop 8 issue is still.
Yeah,
you know, it's gonna. You know, there are people trying to attack it, and as we, that's not a surprise to anyone.
No.
It's tough because you know there are those who are on the.
Do you think that they're going to have to make more of a legal argument about Prop 8 in order to defeat it, as opposed to an argument to the issue of gay marriage? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think if they're going to try and defeat it without creating such a huge blowback that it creates a mini civil crisis, the only way you're going to do it is with the legality issue. Now, in terms of looking at, you know, the sadder part in this is the human part of the issue regarding Prop 8, and that is, you know, I think I mentioned this last week, our blatant sort of lack of tolerance, and even amongst people, and I respect people in the religious community who based on their religious belief, you know, say this is wrong, but even for those people, I still would say, you know, I mean, you understand that's wrong. I understand in your world that's wrong, but do you have a right to impose that on people who think it's right?
I heard a really interesting question about this. Now, I suppose it would depend on how Prop 8 is interpreted within the courts and whether or not they're making a judgment about gay marriage or the process. And here it seemed to be more process-oriented.
Yeah.
However, back in the 80s, the Mormon Church almost lost their standing as a tax-exempt church because they weren't letting black people into the church. And so they sued. People sued the Mormon Church because of that.
Yeah.
Now, some people are drawing parallels between these two things, between gay marriage and, for example, the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you think there's going to be lawsuits against the Catholic Church to get them to lose their tax-exempt status if they're not performing gay marriages? I mean, this is the other side of the argument there, that this is the reason why you want to protect this as far as marriage goes.
Yeah, no, that becomes a real issue, and you know, the Catholic Church, if they were being pushed that way, might capitulate on some issues to save their tax-exempt status. Because let's face it, the amount of money it would cost them to lose that.
It's not like they don't have church. Doesn't,
well, the church they have
got plenty of lawyers.
Oh yeah, plenty of lawyers. I mean, it would be talked up in legalese for so long that it would be, you know,
become a moot issue. I mean, 50 years from now.
Yeah, when we're long gone, and you know, or sipping, you know, stuff through a strainer, you know, it might be a major issue. I mean, that might be resolved, but
we'll be sitting on a porch somewhere having the same old argument. We'll just be two grumpy old men.
Exactly. I'll be 190 years old, but we'll be, you know, Matt, back in 2013. But it's an interesting issue, because I'm sure there'll be someone somewhere who will probably raise this. The question is if they'll be able to get enough of a political platform mm-hmm. in order to push it forward, because the only way they're going to push that forward, to be honest with you, is going to be with mass of people. You'd have to have a sea of people behind mm-hmm. you to build that momentum to get the court to try and even deal with it.
You know, and even the Pope came years ago when he was still cardinal in Argentina talking about civil unions and how he had no problem with civil unions.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's this particular Pope is kind of, you know, enigmatic as far as popes go, in my opinion.
Yeah.
He's pretty unique.
Yeah.
But still, you know, he brought it up as civil unions, and I wonder if that was him in Argentina dealing with a similar issue, because gay marriage was definitely a big issue down there.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Well, and again, I mean, you could certainly make the argument that, you know, the question of what we call it, right? Whether it's a civil union, whether it's marriage, you know, and that's the, I think it's almost like a war of words, if you would, in some ways. It's like, just because
but
we don't like the word.
But in other countries, you have, even heterosexual couples have their civil union and then you have your marriage. And they're two separate things.
Yeah, well, here, you can go to church and get married all day. It doesn't matter at all until you go down to, where do you have to go to get your license?
Yeah.
So you know what? As much as we give great credence to the whole religious connotation of it, the truth of the matter is, it doesn't mean a damn thing until you go down to City Hall and get your license. Otherwise, you know what? It doesn't mean anything. So,
well, that's what paternity suits are for, right?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Alimony and things like that.
Well, exactly.
That's
why those things are. But it does speak to the point of the real issue.
Yeah.
You know, how do you really define it? And if it means that if I was married and I went and I had, you know, it didn't, you know, if I went to church and, you know, and I got married tomorrow, you know, which I won't, but if I was, you know, I could say, great, I'm married, but in the eyes of the state, in the eyes of the city, in the eyes of the federal government, I am not until I go down and sign those papers. So, the same thing for gay couples. I mean, why should it not be any different?
This is sort of a misinterpretation of what the purpose of marriage is.
Absolutely.
Inside a government, right?
Yeah.
Because for the government, it's the only reason they care who I marry is so they can tax me.
Exactly.
They don't care. Other than that, they really don't seem to care who I marry to.
Exactly. They don't. And so the idea is, does the government really care about the issue of gay marriage, or is it just because of the issue regarding what it's going to cost if you institute gay marriage?
Well, this is about, should politics be moralizing and imposing a moral thing, or should it be, you know, kind of, I guess for lack of a better word, amoral? Not anti-moral, just without that kind of agenda.
Well, exactly.
You know?
Well, I think that's really the question. I think when you look at it, you know, because let's face it, if somebody went down and wanted to have a civil union and two gay people wanted to go to a church and get married in their own, you know, in whatever ceremony they wanted to do, I mean, who would know? Who would care? I mean, the truth is, this shows the true essence of the issue. Is again, it's a contract, and it's a business contract in some ways that has religious inference because of the, you know, the notions of how we have historically viewed marriage. But marriage is a partnership, you know, and it's a life, you know, supposedly a lifelong, hopefully lifelong partnership between two individuals. You know, and if they, should you be able to share in the benefit of that with each other because you're lifelong partners? You know, I mean, in my eyes, I'd say, why not? If you have that relationship with that person, why should you not be able to share in the benefit of your lifelong commitment to one another? You know, that should be fair and reasonable, you know, for people. But again, there are people who are intolerant of that notion and really can't get around the idea of, if you chose to do that, you know, then, which I'm not saying you did, but if you chose to do that,
I chose to get married.
You chose to get married, and your beautiful little son walking around here. But I mean, if you chose to, that should be your right to be able to do that. You know.
You know, and at the same time, even within religious context, you know, the Catholic Church does actually have you sign a contract when you get married.
Yeah.
So they're as much aware of the legal implications of this as anything else.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why there's a court system within the Catholic Church and all these other things that a lot of people, I don't think, are as aware of.
Well, it was also a binding agreement. People don't also realize.
In a lot of religions, you actually sign a contract.
Well, but here's the thing, and people don't even understand that. In the Catholic Church, I believe one of the rationale behind that was, you know, it's supposed to keep people married longer because, let's face it, if the consequences of leaving were so high. Like going through a divorce and losing what you would lose.
Well, I don't know if that's the rationale. I suppose you want to take the other side, a different perspective.
We'll take the glass half full side on this one.
Take the glass half full side. It's really about making sure your expectations are out there.
Yeah.
And that's there's a huge process.
Yeah, but here's the thing. But as a contractual agreement, let's face it.
It is a contractual agreement.
Exactly.
It's used in court.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So what that means is that there's the idea, but part of it, I believe, was to make sure it would try to help keep marriages together longer because people would be a lot tougher to get out of them.
I don't know if it's about being tough to get out of them or about keeping them together longer because everybody knows what's expected and they go into it with their eyes open. I think that's the glass half full side.
Well, if that were the case, then how come we wouldn't have as many marriages as we have and people wouldn't have...
Well,
and divorce rate wouldn't be as high as
more,
it is.
More a sign of the times and a sign of the culture and less a sign of the process, right?
Well said. Possibly. But it's interesting to see how California's going to come out on this. And also, I think the federal government... You know, behind the scenes, that's what's funny about Obama and his administration. They do a lot of behind the scenes things that...
There's such lawyers about this. He really is such a lawyer in this. You know, I feel like when I talk to him, it's like, oh, he gives me kind of the brief thing. But then,
The legalese thing.
He goes behind the scenes, and that's how...
That's how business gets done. But it's also, in some ways, it's the way in the society
and
we live in that you
I
have...
I don't trust it. I don't.
We don't trust it, but we understand it, right? Because,
But I felt like, and I got to tell you, it's not that I voted for George Bush Jr. Or necessarily a big Bush guy, but I got to tell you, I felt like he was very upfront with a lot. I felt like Dick Cheney hit everything. Yeah. But I felt like Bush told me.
Well, that's because they would just say "fuck you" if you don't like it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they did.
Excuse me. That was more the impression that they gave. Whereas Obama's got this he's very professorial and very smart, and I feel like when he talks to people, he's working really hard to communicate at our level.
Yeah.
Because he's a smart guy.
Yeah.
Right. So he's got to kind of. I feel like he definitely is trying to come down a few steps. To make sure that he communicates to the general public.
Yeah.
And I think that's where people get afraid or worried or scared.
As they well should, because let's face it, the legalese aspect is something that, the red tape is something that people get bogged down in, or the small words at the bottom of the contract, it says warning. Yeah. You don't get to see that
and
so much.
And things mean different things legally.
Absolutely.
Because the
legal system is just trounced in the gray area, and you keep things sort of ambiguous on purpose so that you can... if you can make a good argument to show that it's left or right or wherever you want it to be, you can do that. But that's the trouble. We get also the beauty of the legal system.
Yeah.
And the more money you have, the better you can argue. And the less money you have, the chances are you're probably not going to win so much.
Yeah.
But that's just how the system works. But this is not going to go away. I think the federal government's going to try and push some sort of a federal product. Some states to try and push federal mandate. There's some states that are still, let's face it, there's some states, that are really struggling with this, particularly in the South. They're already trying to push different legislation.
Mm-hmm.
So civil rights, which is gay rights, civil rights and gay rights are all the same rights. And the issue is, we have to protect the rights of individuals, even those that we may not be, we may not be part of that group, but we still have to protect the rights to make sure we protect our own rights. Mm. Same with women and elderly and all the people, because we'll be elderly one day, hopefully a long time from now. But it's going to happen, so the things you have to protect are also helping you protect yourself.
Yeah.
And that becomes an issue that people forget when they're striking down, issues like civil rights in these areas. We have to be very careful about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's troublesome, very troublesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So Cairo. Cairo, that was the fun thing to watch on all the raw feeds I get in the newsroom.
Yeah,
it was.
And being a Middle East specialist has been fascinating.
Tahrir Square is kind of exploding again, right?
And
so the military takes over.
Yeah,
military takes over and subverts the whole democratic process there, and yet.
Subverts it in the way that we understand.
But still, there's a democratic process in Egypt. People voted for Morsi. For some reason, I keep calling him Morsi, but he's not a 70s rock star.
He might have been. Maybe.
Morsi.
Yeah.
People, they voted for him. He gets in there, and he's only there a year. what kind of real, number one, what kind of real change can you affect in a year? You can't really do anything in a year.
No.
You kind of show up, figure out where everything belongs.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just like you arranging the furniture in your office takes a year.
Exactly.
To figure out how that stuff works and how does the phone work and, oh, do I need to hire staff? And I mean, 6 months into it, he's probably still hiring people that he needs to have managing and working the system.
Yeah.
And he's supposed to fix the Egyptian economy, which has been mired in the
for a decade,
hundreds of years.
Yeah, but in the last decade, in the last decade, it's really gotten really.
It's
horrible. It's really bad.
I mean, it's an economic shithole.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing that happened. You know, as we start this discussion, there's two things that Morrissey, I think, made critical errors on, and one was, you're coming in as a leader in post-revolution period.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to recognize the emotions are high in the people who are looking for democratic change. They're saying, okay, we're going to trust this Islamic leader to try and, with the ties to the Muslim Brotherhood and some other folks, that we're going to trust him to come in and make that change. But they're also trusting him with a very wary eye. And I think Morrissey sort of, because of his own, you know, his own inexperience in this area, to be honest with you, made a calculation error that said that he thought he could push some agendas that this early into his administration were extremely foolish and short-sighted to push. Just too soon from the revolution period to try and push that agenda that he was walking down towards in that situation. And I think it came back to haunt him. Plus, some of those, you know, Islamic laws he tried to push into the Constitution to try and change some of the platform.
So they're a parliamentary system, right?
Yes, they are.
Not like our system.
Yeah, no, parliamentary.
They're more like a British
system. Like Bishop, yeah, exactly.
British or Australian.
Yeah.
So why couldn't the parliament just issue a vote of no confidence and then put somebody else in new office?
You know, that's a good question. It was as to whether, how they could have gone down that road. I think you know, here's the interesting thing about this. And you know, and I remember when I taught this in my course on revolutions at UCSD a couple years ago.
On revolutions?
Yeah, it was a great course. I got to cover four or five different revolutions during that quick 10 weeks.
What did you cover?
I started with the French Revolution because you have to start there.
You're obligated to.
Yeah, exactly. I did the French Revolution. I did the Bolshevik Revolution. I did Cuba, and then I did Iran.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, so I got to cover, and you know, I had the students write their papers, doing some comparative analysis, looking at revolutions.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was fascinating because on one hand, one could make the argument that Egypt had never come out of the revolution.
Mm.
That in fact, it was still, even though it wasn't at the height of the fury and fervor of what happened, you know, 2 years ago, you know, it really was in a point that it was still in the vacuum of revolution, just not in the midst of the heart of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like being in the eye of a storm. You're not in the eye of the storm right now. You're at a different point in the storm, so you're not seeing all the everything whirling around.
Yeah.
But it really wasn't completely out of the revolution. And I'd argue most of the Middle East is still in the throes of dealing with some aspect of within the time frame of a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
From, you know, not from the beginning, but there's a beginning, there's a midpoint, there's an endpoint, and then there's post-revolution realities. You know, and let's face it, when you look at revolutions, if any of those out there, any of our viewers or listeners were to do some historical reading, they would and look at the end of revolutions and how they spin out, very rarely do they end in a situation where the people who start the revolution are very happy about what happens at the end. The people who started the Iranian Revolution did not expect for what took place at the end of that revolution with the Ayatollah coming in and creating the repressive laws that led to the Islamic theocracy.
Because the Iranian Revolution was started as the result of a democratically elected government, and then it was purely economic.
Well, right? There were two things that led. I mean, the economy was in the shreds.
Yeah.
And then the Shah was living opulently, and his people at the top were living opulently, and then the people were starving, and then that bears fruit for the uneducated, who an Islamic fundamentalist to start, and that's when they start clamoring for Ayatollah, who was in Paris at the time. He was in exile in Paris. Mm-hmm. And out of nowhere,
if you're going to be in exile, trust me, being in exile in Paris is
the, if you're going to be, it's a cool, pretty cool place.
Go to Paris.
Exactly. You know, so why did Saddam Hussein go to Paris or somewhere or one of the Cayman Islands and hang out instead of fighting him in a hole in Iraq? You know, I didn't understand that whole thing. His ego wouldn't have let him. Well, he had enough money to go hide. But here's the thing. but I really do think it's an issue of the revolutions have periods. And I think that in Egypt, as in most of the Middle East that are going through revolutionary change, those types of situations are so volatile that you cannot, any type of sweeping radical change that's going to lead down to a potential change from democracy back to a theocratic or quasi-theocratic system becomes very, very tenuous, and you have to be very careful how you go down that road.
I think also the way people kind of perceive revolutions, they kind of have a momentum and a life of their own.
Yeah.
So even when the kind of the bullets stop flying, or what one particular army may be defeated, that doesn't mean that revolution is over.
No.
That doesn't mean that process of whatever change is over at all.
And you forget about the wolves at the door.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, when revolutions happen, for those who are opportunists, whether you're wealthy or whether you've got military power or political clout, those people are the ones who are licking their chops going, then it goes out of being about the revolution. I would even argue during revolutions, the question becomes, how am I, what's in this for me? How do I solidify my power and my economic wealth? And every revolution, there are winners and there are losers. And a lot of times the winners are the people who come out on top economically and financially.
Yeah.
Libya is the same way. Libya is no different. I mean, the people in Libya who end up controlling the system are more concerned about their wealth than they are about the sanctity of democracy.
How do you make money in a revolution? Is there a path to profit?
Just like anything. I mean,
normal. Is there like a predictable? This set of people will make money.
Well, it may not be predictable because it depends on where the tide of the revolution changes. Mm-hmm. Who's who? But like if you're like, say for example, if somebody in a revolution said, "Hey, U.S., I can help you get down this road to fix it." Just like Ahmed Chalabi during Iraq, we made him rich.
Yeah.
Because he gave us false information about what was going on in Iraq. And this guy who didn't have a good history, a good track record at any level, was not a respectable individual. The United States paid him millions and millions of dollars in order for getting falsified half-truth information. And so if the person who's the friend of the U.S. or of the West is the person who's going to first profit, the next person who's going to profit would be, I would argue, the high-end religious leaders who also, even though they believe in Allah and maybe strict Muslims, also got family to feed and look for money in their pockets too. Don't think that just because they're religious.
Pay the rent. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So don't think that just because they're religious doesn't mean that they don't have an economic, conscience either, because they do.
So does this, what's happening in Cairo, North Africa in general, kind of across the Arab world, is that about Islam coming to terms with democracy or coming to terms with kind of the way the world is now, democracy or a republic or whatever.
Well, it's interesting. I think that's part of it. I think this is something going on globally, even outside the realm of Cairo. And I'm going to speak about this for just a quick moment.
Yeah.
You look at like China and Southeast Asia, where you're taking these old communist systems that are creating quasi democracies in their own realm, that are trying to find experiments to see if communism or socialism can meld with democracy, for example. So this is kind of a global experiment in many different ways, shapes, and forms to see what kinds of hybrid democracies can be developed across multiple platforms, whether it's Islam in the Islamic world, or whether it's a political social entity, an economic entity like socialism, communism. And, that's what they have in China. They are in, like, Hong Kong is an economic sector. Zhuhai is an economic sector. Singapore is an economic sector where you don't get kind of repressed like you do in the back hills of China. But the idea is that you can have progress and capitalism and kind of like don't ask, don't tell kind of scenario in some of the more rural areas that then generate the economic wealth of your country. You just kind of turn a blind eye to some of the things that you normally wouldn't turn a blind eye to.
Do you need that kind of social freedom to have that kind of economic growth?
Absolutely. That's why you see in China a developing middle class. The middle class, though, I think in that is going to be, I think it's going to end up being, it's going to, this is a great, comes an interesting experiment as well, because I think it could be like the Iranians in pre-revolution period. You had a burgeoning middle class and an upper class in Iran prior to the revolution. And now you have a burgeoning, swelling middle class in China. And the question is how much power will they accumulate and how much will they be able to push and prod the regimes to move forward and push, progress towards civil society, political socialization, the issues that when you become enlightened, if you would, that you start to push your government toward. Or will their government simply push back and go, no, you can't do this? And that becomes an interesting question. But the paradigm is still the same. You've got to experiment with democracy. And I would argue that we may not call it democracy, and I think I said this to you last week, we may not call this democracy, but in their eyes, having a little bit of freedom and having the ability to remove this guy in the way they did, in a reactionary world of revolution period, this is the closest they can get to it right now. And even when this all settles down, and it'll settle down to some degree, it's going to be years before, if ever, we see any real semblance of a democratic Egypt in the way people may want to envision it. Mm-hmm. You know, it will 10, 20 years from now. The cycle takes longer than that to create democracy. Even if you're trying to get to the way that we have it, it just takes a long time. And you got to build institutions and framework. You got to have a bureaucracy. You've got to have a middle class. You've got to have a vibrant middle class. You've got to have people who contribute in that system. And most of the Middle East is not wired that way. And so, can you create aspects of it? Absolutely. But that's where I say you'll have, you know, these quasi-democracies. They won't look like ours look. They'll be homegrown and indigenous democracies in a way that those people can understand. And that might be the closest we can get to it, at least in the next 10 to 20 years, at least, maybe longer. Yeah, it's a fascinating, but here's the other thing. Let me share with you one other aspect of this. I don't mean to over-talk, thinking about this. And one of the struggles, particularly in Egypt right now, is that you have so many opposition groups that are all nipping at the heels of the system. And the question in this is, who comes to power, right? And because there are people who believe that, go back to the old school, who want to see the army come back in. Mm-hmm. There is that want to see the former leader come back in. There are those who want to see Islamic State. There are those who want, the young people who want to see secular state. So you have all these different factions that are all pulling against each other. And that becomes very complex and complicated because everybody wants to share power. And the question is, how do you keep some level of equality or equity in the system, or create a system of plurality? Plural, that's one of those words. Plurality. Say it 10 times, right?
Yeah.
But the question simply is whether or not, you know, how do you get to that in a situation in countries like this? And that's, you know, the whole peaceful coexistence thing goes out the window quite a bit during this time, you know. And people become rather intolerant. They sound good when they're all in revolution. When the revolution winds down, I'm like, I want mine. You want yours, and that's the morning after.
Yeah. Yep. The morning after the night before.
I should write on this, actually. I should do some writing on this.
Yeah, the morning after the night before in Egypt.
Yeah, exactly. Morning after revolution. That's actually, you know what?
Your hangover.
I think I've got my book.
Yeah, there you go.
Damn, okay, hey, thanks, Matt.
All right, you're welcome. I am an inspiration to many.
Yeah, actually, that's great. Revolution is the morning after.
The morning after. Yeah. That'd be good.
I think I'm kidding, right?
No, I'm not. Obama was talking about when he was in Africa. He was just before going to Africa, and he was in Belfast. He was talking about creating a North American European free trade zone.
Yeah.
I don't understand what that means for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like I hear this talk, and it doesn't seem to make any sense for me.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean I can suddenly go live and work in Europe. It's not like we're going to become members.
If it did, we'd be there now, right?
Yeah.
We'd be doing this from...
Like I said, I'd be in exile in Paris if I had to choose. Exactly. Right?
The Eiffel Tower would be behind us. We'd be doing this right now, right?
You know, they won't let you, though. you need a permit to shoot at the Eiffel Tower.
We'll just be a block or two away behind us.
We'd make friends with somebody at a cafe.
Exactly. But that's an interesting thing because the economic... This free trade agreement is about trying to build something that's already in place and unofficially.
Yeah.
I mean, we've always had.
I can do business in Europe.
Yeah.
If I had a business here and I wanted to sell in Europe, it's really pretty easy with few exceptions to do business.
Well, half the G7, 8, 9, whatever the heck number it is today, right? Whoever's part of the boys club this week, mostly comprised the U.S. and Europe. I mean, most of the countries are part of U.S. and Europe. I don't know how Italy got in there because, I mean, I like Italy a lot. It's a great country, but their economy's in such bad shape. How do they get to be part of the GA, right? But here's the thing. This is supposed to create even a greater economic cooperation. And part of this, I really believe, is that Europe and the United States both recognize that we're tethered to each other economically. They buy our bonds, we buy their bonds. Mm-hmm. When the euro collapsed, the blowback in the U.S. was pretty significant. The same thing would happen when our economy collapsed, the blowback in Europe was significant. So consequently, trying to create almost an EU-US economic zone, if you would, to try and figure out how to counteract or balance probably against the Chinas of the world and countries where they have cheap labor but maximize their economies in the way that the U.S. and Europe hasn't been able to do because we don't have cheap labor markets like they do.
Or is it that they can really shit on the environment?
It's probably a combination of both.
You can't do that, and it's cheaper to shit on the environment in China. Because labor's cheap here. I mean, let's face it. I mean, labor's...
Well...
If you're going to... I mean, I don't
know... Not to manufacture. I mean, if you can't get cheaper than Mexico, or you can't get cheaper than China, or
but you can also just absolutely shit on the environment there. I've been just across the border, the Maquilas. I remember doing stories on the Eveready factory there. It was a field about the size of this park, 6 feet high of old Eveready batteries that just were ditched in the field.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was a Tidy Bowl factory, and they would just... They would just, all of their wastewater just went out this one pipe that was about 6 inches wide and just shot down into this little creek. So the whole creek smelled like Tidy Bowl that ran down there. And people ended up with all kinds of weird diseases.
Well, I mean.
It's bizarre.
Well, that's
because they can just crap all over the environment.
Well, I mean, that's unfortunate. I mean, that we live in a world where
you couldn't do that in the States. You'd have to dispose of any waste properly.
Well, that's what we say.
Well, that's not what we do. But still,
go back to Love Canal. Go to Love Canal, 1979, and go look what happened.
But that's 79. Today, you know, there's been advancement since then.
Yeah, right? but here's the thing.
You think you could get away with something near? You couldn't get away with.
Yeah,
Love
but
Canal
here, but I'll tell you, what the problem with legislatively speaking, here's what happens. The biggest problem is that if you, let's say you own a chemical company, and you were dumping toxic chemicals into the back canal that was causing three-headed kids. Okay.
Three brains are better than one. I'm not causing three-headed kids. I'm creating superheroes.
Right? Supermen, all in one body. But here's the thing. Yeah, we're doing Comic-Con next week, so this is a.
Oh yeah.
But here's the great thing. The thing about this is that usually, once I catch you, and let's say I catch you doing this, the average amount of time that you get to fix the problem. You know what the average amount of time you get?
No.
Between 15 and 20 years to fix the problem. 15 to 20 years
to
fix a
problem. Does it just take that long to fix that kind of damage?
No. Well, I mean, certainly the ecosystem probably needs that. But part of it, but then you get to keep dumping your mess along the way because, you know.
I can continue and go, I'm fixing it.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. Because it's like you're supposed to reduce it a minimum. Because here's what happens. In a lot of cases, it's like, God forbid it be the economic blowback of what it's going to hurt your company because of what you've been doing and, you know, you just realized and had a crisis of consciousness, which is a bunch of BS. But the issue is simply is that it's not like they say, okay, you're busted, stop today, fix your crap, and then we'll let you start up again. We'll give you time. And the short side is 10 years, the long side is 20, and usually somewhere in between is where the spectrum goes. That's a hell of a long time to keep dumping toxic chemicals into the environment.
So you can get away with a lot in the
absolutely,
States.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think much more than people realize. We just try. We know, not that we don't care. People are not consciously trying to deal with it, but there are a lot of people who don't deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, who don't deal with it. So it's like...
So labor is the big cheap.
Oh, yeah.
People are cheap.
Yeah. And it's even in our own society.
People are cheap.
People are cheap, you know, and we're just not cheap enough is a problem. I mean, that's why manufacturing is left in the United States.
I was listening to Chris Christie, reruns of him arguing with teachers' unions.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard any of this stuff? And he was telling teachers, well, why are you teaching then if you don't like how much you're being paid? Do something else. It's like, what?
Yeah.
It's like, it just doesn't seem to quite grasp the process, the idea that you want good teachers and you want to be competitive, and his was like, well, then don't teach.
You know, that's angering.
And
I make me want to sock him in the head.
Well,
you know?
I hear talk like that, and I'm it reminds me that when public schools came into effect, when a publicly paid police force and fire department came into effect, those were seen as socialist institutions.
Yeah.
And there was huge blowback against it.
Yeah.
I mean, Pinkertons were a security force that you would hire.
Yeah.
And if you didn't pay your fire tax and have that fire medallion out front of your building,
your building would burn down.
It caught on fire, it would burn down. They wouldn't help it.
Yeah.
Now, you know, and then, you know, if you wanted your kids to go to school, you needed to pay for them to go to school. There were no public schools.
Yeah.
It didn't work that way.
No. It was an elitist operation. Everything was elitist.
But then I hear Chris Christie talking like this.
Yeah.
Is there a push against? I mean, there's already some privatization of police forces in New Jersey.
Yeah.
You know, in his state.
Yeah.
He's already contracting out police services to private security in some smaller towns in New Jersey.
Yeah.
You know, and I know that you know, I've talked to people within sort of the San Diego POA, the Police Officer Association here, and that's a worry they have here as well, that there's going to be some push towards privatization of some aspects of the police force and the fire department. There's already that push for schools.
Yeah, they'll hire Z Corporation, former Blackwater, to be the private security for the city.
Yeah, but I mean, great. Is there a Republican push against this because they see these things as socialist, part of a socialist agenda? Or do you think people just aren't aware that that's the history of these things and that this is not necessarily a bad thing?
Well,
is it about perspective or kind of a hidden economic agenda?
Hey, look, you know, no surprise to me. I mean, let's face it, in the most affluent communities in our country, they all have private security anyway. Yes, they have access to a police force, but if you go to Beverly Hills, Beverly Hills has its own police force. You go behind closed gates of even Rancho Santa Fe,
they have their own
internal police or security force. Yeah, the SDPD can respond given a certain situation, but they have their own separate forces anyway. I just don't want to see
it come. And those are private roads. And it's almost like the Fourth Amendment really matters if you're rich.
Yeah.
And it's not like the police can just go down a private road.
Exactly.
You need a warrant to get into a private road.
Yeah.
Unless there's some sort of imminent danger.
Danger, yeah. Right? But here's the thing is that should it come at the sacrifice of the public safety? Because this is always that mixer. I think people who the haves in society don't realize that, you know, the corrosion of the infrastructure of the security safety of our cities also impacts you because somebody could come knock on your door too, and that just having a private security force, you know, people who are minimum wage workers who are struggling too to have them in your neighborhood doesn't
make you any
safer
either. Well, they've got this in the prison system now too. I mean, Corrections Corporation of America is the prison for all undocumented immigrants that are caught up in the system in San Diego County.
Yeah.
Almost this entire Southern California region, but I could be wrong on that.
But here's the thing, maybe let's face it, most prisons are now privatized, corporate prisons.
You can invest in them, it's like $28 a share.
Yeah, and it's like big money. You know, prisons are big money-making operations. Think about the cost of running a prison and the economic cost of running a prison. Think about how much money, let's say I'm no knock on Campbell's Soup, but let's say if Campbell's Soup were supplying the soup for prisons, how much money that makes for Campbell's Soup?
Well, I mean,
I'm just saying this as an example.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know. Well, there's that. There's the commissary. It's crazy. Yeah. It's like $5 a soda.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. You know, I heard this.
But that's what I'm saying. So there's an economic reality.
They get about $180 a day per prisoner.
Yeah.
With a 2-month maximum stay. So everyone who gets rounded up and thrown into that system always will stay for 2 months.
Yeah.
Before they're basically released on their own recognizance most of the time, unless they're serious dangers to the community.
Exactly.
The other thing that gets me too is that they've got people in there that are basically people without states. So they were rounded up by INS and then they're African and their country doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And so no one will take them.
Yeah.
But they've been stuck in this prison now for 2 years.
Or longer.
Or you get the mentally ill people that are stuck there and they have no place to send them.
No. We haven't because, and this is again partially because,
should these kinds of things be privatized? Should prisons, fire, schools, police, should they be privatized?
See, I think that's a really bad idea. I just think it's a bad, I think when you start getting down the road of privatization, then you're also getting on the road of picking and choosing who lives and who dies, which is also, unfortunately, what we've done with healthcare. Let's face it, if you've got money, you can get drugs that people who don't have healthcare can't get. That's why during the AIDS epidemic, when it was really at its epic point, you know, the average person who, when you were found out to be HIV positive and then, you know, going through the process, well, you know, you had maybe a 5-year life expectancy, you know, and then, but the people who, I mean, are, you know, like Magic Johnson, you know, I mean,
yeah, he's still alive.
I mean, he doesn't even show up in his system now, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thankful for him and I'm thankful for people who managed to survive who are able to get drugs now. But during that time, if you were not rich, you could not get the drugs to survive.
Well, what the Brazilians did is they just said that they were going to violate the patents anyhow.
Yeah.
That was something that their government did, and they just said, we're just going to violate the patent and
get people
these drugs.
Get people help.
There was a huge, because you're not making them in a way that any of our people can afford.
Yeah.
Because they had a system where they just gave healthcare away. So it because of that, there was that pressure.
Yeah,
I mean, you know. They're all part of the same thing, though.
And exactly.
I think taking more of a humanistic look at these things with regard to the economy is more the direction we should be going.
Well, yeah. Well, and I think the economy, I think it costs us more to not do it than it costs us to do it in the long run.
Well, you know, I mean, I was talking to somebody, and they were saying how they think the World Bank is a left-wing organization. I don't quite agree with that.
Ooh, okay.
But
left of what?
World Bank ranks countries based, and they have this out, and they do this every 2 years, and they rank countries based on their GDP, how much they spend on their healthcare.
Yeah.
And the United States is number 4, and we spend 17% on our health of our GDP on healthcare.
Yeah.
Whereas pretty much all of the rest of the Western countries spend about 10% of their GDP on healthcare. And I think of places like the UK that have healthcare systems, and I've been in those systems. And that's the other thing that kills me about people who make this argument against any kind of nationalized system. None of them have ever actually been in those systems, or they make some wild accusation. Oh, if you're in Russia, which is just...
Yeah, you have to wait for hours and hours to go see a doctor.
You know, I've never met... I've had one appointment with my GD in San Diego.
Yeah.
When I lived in France, I just walked in and the guy met me.
Yeah.
You know, my sister had two kids in Scotland.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, here's the thing.
I had a buddy who had a child in Scotland, and they gave him a bill for $20. Huh. And he went home.
Yeah.
You know, the hospitals in you know, when we had our kid at Mary Birch, it's considered to be one of the best hospitals in the country, and they still can't get World Health Organization status as being a women-centric hospital. And they're a women-centric hospital in the United States, but they're just not at that level.
Yeah.
They just aren't there yet. I don't think there are any hospitals in the United States that have that yet. Whereas there's hospitals in I know the one in Edinburgh does, there's one in London, there's Paris. But we can't meet that standard.
Yeah.
And we're privately paid. Why are these publicly paid hospitals in countries, and they're spending less on their healthcare there?
Yeah, substantially less.
7% of a GDP is a huge chunk of money.
Yeah. But the same goes across the board. I mean, I know we're talking about a much broader issue, but I mean, look at education the same way. I mean,
it costs them less in the long run because they don't have as many people in prison as a result of spending all this money on education.
Exactly.
You know, we've got more people in prison than China has people in prison. It's not just because China kills everyone that's in prison.
Yeah, no. It's a sociological observation that needs to be looked at, but it's also a fact of looking at sort of the model that we've put in place. Our socioeconomic model is a troublesome model. It is. It's a very troublesome model when you think about
it. It's a lack of political education. I was talking to Arturo, and he was the guy who came on and did the torture special with us.
Yeah.
And he talks about how basically political education in the United States, they talk about how capitalism is great, democracy is great, but then they never talk about there's actually good aspects to other forms of government.
Exactly.
And they never talk about that. All you ever get is, oh, communism doesn't work, it's idealistic, therefore it fails.
Yeah.
And if you're a communist, then you're going to get fat and lazy and you won't do anything.
Yeah.
Which is such a simplistic look
on
that system, on any socialist system, any of the ways they've been interpreted.
Well, they homogenize them. They tell you, well, you're going to make the same money as I make whether you're a pilot or a garbage collector.
Yeah. And therefore, the garbage collector's job is of less value.
Yeah.
And so then they automatically make a class judgment based on that.
Exactly.
But you can't, why is it we can't teach these things honestly, particularly not in public schools?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. We should be able to. We should be able to do it in public schools. The sad part, that's one of the sad testaments to the structure of our system, is that how we go about educating our public about the issues. And we could start that at a very young age so that the kids could be, even little kids could, starting in, you know, third, fourth, fifth grade, can understand the general context of understanding what healthcare really is. You can do is very start building that understanding for them at a very young age, so that by the time they're older, they can synthesize the information and be able to make good decisions. The problem is we start down here, and then we don't do that. you know, it's like we socialize our kids a certain way too, but we keep them out of the realm of understanding. They know who the presidents are. Maybe they learn a little bit of that. They learn a little bit about, you know, what things can do, but they don't understand. We don't teach them the direct relationship between input and outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't teach them that. We don't teach them that if what the importance of, you know, the education is in terms of, you know, what happens in society with a good education. You've got to be able to teach those things so they understand why they're learning. Kids now, I think across the board, want to understand, why do I have to know this?
Well, I was never taught that. I wouldn't even say kids now. I would say this sort of has been the system.
Yeah, but it's a system that we have to be able to go beyond and now be able to look and say, what can we correct of what we've been doing that isn't working, to create something that is viable for the kids of the 21st century. And I think in many ways we have failed the kids of the 21st century. I think we failed the ones of the last decade or two, because cost of education is prohibitive, kids will never be out of debt. The ones who graduate from college can't find jobs. I ran into a former student of mine just a couple days ago downtown. Who's driving a taxi. Can't find a job. You know, it's like, so the reality of that.
I have a good friend with PhD, and she's a meter maid in L.A.
Yeah, probably make more money than she'd make if she had, you know, but she can't work in the field she loves simply because of what this actually represents. So. Yeah. It's a real problem, and I think it's a socialization problem that we have, that is a conscious choice and decision that's been made by people within the infrastructure of our country to let these things go by the wayside. Just like ours, and again, I go back and I use the analogy real quickly of our history books. You know, history is written in such a way that allows for, it creates a certain a reflection about who we think we are as people, as opposed to what the actualities are. I think I mentioned to you before when I first went to UCLA. You know, I didn't know who Ralph Bunche was. I remember going to this political science department for the first time. I see Ralph Bunche. I see this bust out in front. I'm like, who is this guy? So they said, you don't know who Ralph is? I don't know who Ralph Bunche is. No, you know, this guy was the first head of the UN. You know, African American. I mean, I would argue. I bet you more than 80% of the African Americans in the country don't know who some of the major premier African Americans who've done amazing things in the society, who they are, what they've done. It's tremendous. I mean, absolutely tremendous. To the point where I actually, when I did my American politics course, I did one for blacks, Latinos, Asians, Hispanics, and I went through and said, these are what the inventors in America from these different ethnic groups have actually created in our society. And my students were just shocked. You know, the students who are not of those groups were just shocked at what people from those groups had created in our society that they take for granted every single day. I mean, amazing stuff.
Peanut butter.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, plasma.
Yeah. People who think, you know, everything that was done. But if you're trying to teach kids from those groups to have certain sort of self-pride and sort of look to themselves in a different light, you have to educate them that way. But if you keep that out of their history books, out of their discussion, then what do you create in those people? Mm-hmm. You can create your own monsters, is what I'm saying, by your own genuflection. Yeah. You know? So it's a problem. It's a real problem.
So do you think Bolivia, do you think Snowden is going to make it? Is Snowden going to make it to Bolivia? Isn't he trapped in a Moscow airport now? Is he sleeping in a Moscow airport,
this,
I think?
This reminds me of that Tom Hanks movie.
Bathroom.
What was the Tom Hanks movie? The one where he was in the airport, stuck in the airport?
Tom Hanks?
Yeah, he's in a movie where he was stuck in the airport.
I do remember that one.
He was like from somewhere in Eastern Europe and he was stuck. And they wouldn't let him in. He wouldn't let him out.
He couldn't go anywhere. He lived in the airport.
This is the Snowden thing, only Snowden's the much more problematic individual.
Yeah.
You know, with a direct personal agenda that I think is not altruistic and not honorable in what he's doing.
Well, WikiLeaks would totally disagree with you there.
Well, I know WikiLeaks would, but I mean, look at the political agenda.
As far as the kind of the extreme on that.
I know. Well, I mean, but you think about, if you were, you know, in order to understand what is Snowden's real purpose in what he's doing. What's his real purpose? Did he have a crisis of consciousness where he wants the American public to know the dirty secrets of America, or what's the real issue?
You don't buy that, because that's what he's trying to play. Yeah,
I think it's bullshit. I'm sorry. It is. You know, I think he's got an agenda, and he's trying to. You know, he may be trying to play the wiki thing, but I don't. Mm-hmm. He doesn't strike me as the wiki person. He strikes me as the person who has got an ego problem and got some other issues that he's realizing now are going to come back to haunt him.
Do you think he's going to make it to Bolivia, Venezuela?
Venezuela said they were taking Bolivia. Said they take him. Who else did they?
Why would you want to go live in Caracas? That place is a freaking nightmare. Crime is all over the place. It's horrible. Bolivia. Even.
Yeah, because they'll probably put him up someplace nice.
It's not like
he's getting
any decent choices.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
He's not going into exile in Paris.
Yeah, exactly, exactly, exactly. Yeah, ultimately, this is the kind of situation where, you know, guys like this.
And what's he looking at? He's not looking at like a treason prosecution. He was a contractor.
Yeah.
Right. So he's looking at whatever his criminal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly you have access.
It's going to be in the federal system.
Yeah. Well, because he had top secret clearance, so the access to information, and then there's a consequence. I mean, so he's got criminal action against him.
I mean, and the irony is, it's not, and he, you know, I heard this thing about him complaining about how people just don't care.
Yeah.
It's not that people don't care. People knew this was happening a long time ago.
Yeah.
And people want this kind of thing to happen in a way.
Yeah.
Because they want there to be, you know.
Yeah,
you want, where does the chatter come from?
Yeah.
And they say, oh, CIA heard chatter. How do they hear chatter?
Yeah. Well, even now, what's coming out about, you know, us tapping into the Europeans, tapping into us. I mean,
that's been going on for forever.
Yeah, I remember
a story in the 80s when there was an actual physical line that ran from, and I want to say Finland to Russia, uh-huh. in that part that ocean up there.
Yeah.
And we were somehow, one of our subs was somehow able to just drop a cable over that line and then tap into every Russian communication that was coming in or out of there, going all the way to any of their embassies. Yeah. We were able to tap into that.
Yeah.
Just because of the way that communication worked.
Yeah.
And that was how we did it then.
See.
Now we just go to the phone companies.
Yeah. Now we just go to Verizon or whoever. Yeah,
Verizon, and say, give us this stuff or you don't get your permit.
Yeah.
Basically, right?
Yeah. So you'll lose billions and billions of dollars if you
and
don't.
They, okay.
Yeah, and they give it up and they just take the blowback.
And then they're not looking at individuals. They're looking for patterns, and then they use those patterns to find individuals. Does that make sense?
Well, think about how fast that Verizon thing blew out of the from being main front stream news to now nobody even talks about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, what happened? Did that stop all of a sudden?
Yeah.
Or did people just kind of go, our limited notion of being able to, you know, raise hell was about a week or two long, and then we forget about everything.
Yeah.
Which is the problem. Whoa. That's the problem. That's the problem in America for the most part.
Yeah.
I mean... You know,
we were going to talk about media and politics. I mean, we're already over an hour.
I know. So
right
we'll have to come back next week. Yeah, we have a big thing to talk about. I mean, I think it's an important thing for us to discuss with the public. I think it's good. It'll be a good discussion.
That's such a tough one, though.
Yeah.
Because you can't force people to watch stuff.
No, but you still got to try and give them what they need.
That's what the British
do.
They make all other TV really boring.
Yeah.
And so you're forced to watch the news.
Yeah, I mean, Sky
News.
Well, Sky News and BBC, I mean, there's moments where they have something.
Well,
I mean,
Sky News is like the Fox. It's the Fox News.
It's the Fox News, yeah. But BBC, I mean, I've seen a couple of times where it's a little more engaging, but at least they give it to you. At least they don't shy away from giving you real stuff, which is what I appreciate.
They're publicly funded, though.
Yeah.
I mean, and they're, American media is not publicly funded.
Yeah. It'd be nice if we had a publicly funded news of sorts.
I mean, even PBS.
PBS is the closest we get to it.
1% of their budget
is public.
So even if PBS lost their funding from Congress, which people like to say, oh, that would destroy PBS, it wouldn't do a thing.
Yeah.
PBS would continue to function. They've got trusts. They've got endowments.
Yeah.
Donations.
Yeah, they're set for a long, long
time.
They're
not going away.
They're set for a long, long time. By far.
Yeah.
By far. Yeah.
The park.
We're at the park.
And so next week we're going to go record at Comic Book Store.
Yeah.
And that'll be our Comic Con special.
Yeah. I told Jamie that my good friend Jamie, he'll be here next Sunday to join us.
What's the comic book store?
Southern California Comics over in Kearny Mesa, right off Kearny Mesa Boulevard. And across from the bullpen.
You were a huge comic book nerd. I
still am. I still am. I collect. I have about 8,000 in my collection that one day my kids will enjoy and... hopefully make a lot of money on.
Yeah, my father would not let me read comics.
Well, I'll tell you what.
He was afraid I wouldn't read.
Well, let me tell you,
books.
I learned to read from reading comics. I learned what an Aurora Borealis was when I was 7 years old from reading Superman. Swear to God.
Wow.
And here's the thing, it's interesting. Just not too long ago, he sold his first Spider-Man. If you tell your dad this, I bet he likes it. Your dad understands money. My friend Jamie bought it.
He doesn't understand money. He was a public defender. He was a writer and a public defender.
Yeah.
He doesn't understand money.
Yeah,
obviously, he doesn't
understand money. My friend Jamie bought a huge collection a few months ago. It cost a significant amount of money. I won't say the amount.
Oh, I'm sure.
But he sold the Spider-Man for in excess of about $40,000 to $50,000.
Holy fuck.
Yeah, for a 12-cent comic book.
Yeah.
So imagine a 12-cent comic book.
Yeah.
That's one, by the way, of a huge collection that he...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so the idea is, I mean, the value in these things is what, you know, I think kids learn from things that engage them. I was engaged in, you know, loved Superman growing up as a kid. I was like, wanted to know what the words said on the page. I started trying to learn the words. And, you know, I was reading at, you know, 5, 6 years old. I mean, really reading well. And
good.
You know?
Yeah.
So I just always had that fascination. I still like to read a good comic book.
No,
you know?
I did.
They've
not
grown up
that.
A lot.
My
since
father
the days
gave
of...
me a copy of Huckleberry Finn and sat me down and forced me to read it.
Yeah.
And I'll never. Well, you know, he did what he thought was right. I'm not going to judge him now. He did what he thought was right at the time.
Yeah.
And he likes me.
Yeah. You sure about that?
I think he likes me.
Yeah. I read Tom Sawyer to my son just recently. And
I got to tell you, I love Mark Twain.
Yeah, he's a great writer.
You know,
really,
probably be one of those things I'll force my kid to read too.
Yeah, there's some great books that kids need to get into. So I mean, the whole idea of
Mark Twain is pretty simple read too.
Yeah,
it's not anything Twain wrote. They're funny, they're witty, they're intelligent, but they're very easy reads.
Exactly.
Twain, Steinbeck, Hemingway, they're all really easy to read.
And
they they turn into new things as you get older.
Exactly. But I love the fact that you can take them in as a kid and then read them as an older person and be able to still get something from them.
Yeah.
Pretty profound in that, you know?
Comic books are the same way.
Yep, they are. So, yeah, they are.
Look at that. All right, well, next week.
Next week.
Bullet's Desk Political Podcast. We'll be at a comic book store. Are we going to do it at the store?
Or
we'll
see.
Have to find a location.
We'll see. We'll see.
We
might
do it at the store.
We might do it.
We're going to try and talk him into letting us do it at the store.
Which I'm sure he would. I'm sure he would love us to do it.
If he doesn't let us do it at the store, then.
Yeah, what? Cut him out. No,
we'll just spend a half an hour ripping.
Jamie, we're going to come to you, your comic book store. So he'll love that. He'll love that, actually. He'll love that.
All right. Cool. All right.
Have a great week. Have a great Sunday, you guys.